hour, would I? So Padmavajra started at Buddha Gaya, giving us vignettes from the Udana. And I'm going to go to Buddha Gaya too. In fact, I go there every year, if possible twice a year, and I've even got a small place where I can stay there. And it's a wonderful place. It's a horrible place, actually, but it's wonderful as well. It's the most dreadful Indian tourist town, and they get pretty bad. It's chaotic, exploitative, really quite unpleasant in many ways. But, of course, at its heart is the Mahabodhi Temple, and especially with the Bodhi tree. And to be there, even though that can be pretty horrible too, because Buddhist pilgrims are pretty determined, and if you stand in their way, they can trample you down. But it's just wonderful to be there. There's a very, very strong, very deep atmosphere at Bodh Gaya. And whenever I'm there, I spend as much time as I can under the Bodhi tree, right close to the temple, just sitting, just absorbing more than anything, the Buddha's absence, actually, but through his absence, his presence. It's a very, very strong experience, which I highly recommend to anybody who hasn't had it. Very important for us as Buddhists, I think, to go again and again to Bodh Gaya, because you get a sort of immediacy of connection with the Buddha that you can't really get in any other way. But I remember on that Udana seminar, I was on the second one, the first one, the tapes got lost, so Bantu did it again. On that second one, I remember Bante talking about the Buddha, the Bodhivagga, the first chapter of the Udana, which Padmavajra mentioned. And it's not all under the Bodhi tree. The first few suttas are located under the Bodhi tree, but as the suttas go on, they're located at different places around Uruvela, which is what Bodh Gaya was called at that time. So a number of incidents take place in a number of different places around the Bodhi tree. And what Bante said was that you shouldn't think of the Buddha's enlightenment as a one-off process. Something happened, there was before and after, that was that. That it wouldn't have been like that. And that's what the suttas, these suttas and others found elsewhere in the canon, show to us. The Buddha spent quite a long time around the Bodhi tree, around the area of the Bodhi tree, what is now the Mahabodhi Temple, and the immediate vicinity thereof. Tradition later said 5 weeks, and even later said 7 weeks, to bring it up to proper magical standards, as it were. Later tradition ascribed different weeks to different places around the temple. Now, the temple authorities have, my goodness, found those places. Not entirely convincingly, but convincingly enough, or for the eye of faith enough. But there is one place that I'm particularly fond of. It's, if you know the Mahabodhi Temple, you come down a long flight of steps to ground level, where you're on the level with the Mahabodhi Temple. And at the bottom of those steps, there's a big pillar. It's an Ashokan period pillar, marking an important spot in the Buddha's immediate experience after his enlightenment. Next to it, there's a concrete pillar with a sign on it, saying that this is the upper Ajapala Nigrodha tree. And many pilgrims worship the sign, which is a wonderful thing. You can see people have started to paint the sign gold, you know, with gold leaf and so on. It doesn't matter, does it? But anyway, the pillar marks the place where there was a tree, a Nigrodha tree, a banyan tree, You know, these wonderful trees which send back their roots into the ground, which are really wonderful for protecting you from the glare of the sun and even the rain. You can sit right inside them, almost like being in a house. So you can imagine the Buddha being in this banyan tree, under the roots of the banyan tree, which was the goat herd's banyan. So it's where the goat herd used to sit, as goat herds do all over the world, on a stone with his back against the tree, with his goats all around, occasionally shouting out, as goat herds will, and throwing a stone or two, and so on. But anyway, the Buddha sat there. And a number of important things happened to him there. One that particularly striking for us in India is that it's there that the Buddha really confronted the Brahminical social order and completely rejected the doctrine that worth was based on birth. That he rejected the Brahminical social order and asserted an ethical and spiritual order in its place. So in India we say that's where the Dhamma revolution began. That's where the Buddha began to undermine the hierarchical order based on power and wealth and so on, and asserted that real value comes from inside, comes from your human development. So this is one of the incidents that happened there. But another one took place there, which is what I'm going to talk about today. While he was there, the Buddha began to reflect on his position. He'd gained enlightenment, and he discovered something that he knew nobody had ever discovered before. He'd gone where no man had trod. And he began to think that this put him in a very odd position. He says that he reflected that who could he revere and rely upon? He said that if you can't revere and rely on anybody, it's sorrow, it's sadness, it's suffering. This itself is extremely important. I've talked about this before. I talked about it at the last convention. I'm not going to cover exactly the same ground, but another aspect I want to draw out. But it is worth just dwelling for a moment on the Buddha's feeling of the need to revere. The Buddha needed to revere. I think it's well worth reflecting just on that fact. Even the Buddha, the human being who attained the pinnacle of what a human being can achieve, still felt the need to revere and recognized that not being able to revere is painful, is sorrowful. Why? Because you're thrust back on you. And when we face it, brothers and sisters, what a pretty miserable thing that is to be thrust back on, to get all our meaning, all our worth, simply from our own ego identity. It's not enough. And there's a whole possible disquisition here, because I think that our Western culture has removed reverence. In our attack on false hierarchies, jolly good, well done, Washington and Jefferson and all the rest of it. Not so well done, Robespierre. But in the removal of false hierarchies, we've removed positive hierarchies too. And that is sorrow, that is pain, a pain which runs through our cultural life. The failure to revere, the difficulty of reverence. You know, so much of our time is spent debunking, pulling down, criticizing, finding fault with, even within our own movement. So much time spent in finding the faults. My goodness, if you look for them, they are everywhere. But yes, even the Buddha feels the need to revere. So he thinks, well, who shall I revere? He thinks, there's nobody who's more ethical than me. So I can't look to somebody who's more ethical than me to revere them. There's nobody more with deeper meditation experience than me. So I can't revere anybody under that heading. There's nobody wiser than me, so I can't revere under that heading. Saying this in all modesty, if you see what I mean. He just knows, he wants somebody to, he could look up to, but he can't find anybody. There's nobody more liberated than me. There's nobody who knows they're liberated more than I do. There's nobody I can look up to. And so he says, what shall I do? Who shall I dwell revering, looking up to, honouring, paying homage to, you could say, putting above me, putting on my head, relying upon? Who can I look to who as a source of guidance, as a source of reliance in the sense of being able to think that their view will put me on the right track? I can't find anybody to whom I can direct apotrapia, this sense of moral values derived from those who are more developed than you. There's nobody I can look to for that sort of moral guidance. So he said, what shall I do? He says, I shall live revering and relying upon this Dhamma that I have awakened to. So it's this that I want to reflect upon a little bit in this context, because I think it ties in with our themes over these few days, and I want to make that a little bit clearer. I've long wanted to speak about this. I've spoken about other aspects of the Gaudiya Sutta, which I think is an exceptionally important sutta, but I've not gone into this. I should just mention that Bhante himself has derived an enormous sort of confidence and validation from that sutta. He says he finds it extraordinary that modern Theravadin commentators bypass that sutta or explain it away, as it were. Its real significance doesn't seem to have hit people. But he says for him, it explained and revealed his own experience in a way that, he really wanted to find. So, the Buddha said he's going to live revering and relying upon the Dhamma. So the Buddha, the one who's enlightened, the one who's woken up, who's attained sambodhi, samyak sambodhi, the highest reach of a human wit, the highest attainment that a human can achieve, sum and total of what it's possible for consciousness to attain, complete freedom from identity, freedom from clinging to identity. He is going to revere. What it's the Dhamma that he's going to revere. What's that mean? What does that really mean? What is it for the Buddha to revere anything, for a start, since he's after all gone beyond all ego clinging? What is it for him to revere? Let me deal with that side of it first. Of course, yes, the Buddha has attained enlightenment, and we know that enlightenment consists in seeing through the eye-maker, the ahankara, the strong habitual force that constantly seeks in every situation identity. It seeks to find in every situation I, seeks to find something to identify with and something to identify against, if you see what I mean, because identification is as much to do with saying who you are, it's to do with saying who you aren't. So this tendency, this ahankara, is what the Buddha goes beyond. I think it's quite important to think of it like that. We talk about ego, but of course it isn't a thing. What we're really talking about is this strong habitual tendency, again and again, which comes from the past, is recreated again and again, the strong tendency to interpret our experience in terms of a fixed self and other. And it's constant. It's happening again and again. As soon as it breaks down in one context, we redo it. We do it again. So it's more of a tendency than a thing, if you see what I mean. And it's not that we have an ego that we have to get rid of. We have to see through this tendency to identity, to identify and to disidentify. That's what we have to see through. So the Buddha's seen through that, and yet he's wanting to rely on and revere. So who is it who's revering and relying, if you like? If he's seen through that, who is it who can do the revering and relying? Well, it seems to me that the solution to this conundrum lies in the recognition, well, that the Buddha is still in a human body. He has a human form. He has human senses. He has a human nervous system. He has a human brain. Until he enters parinirvana, that will continue. And this human psychophysical organism naturally delivers experience which is bifurcated. Do you see what I mean? So just to be a human being, just to have eyes, just to have nerves, just to have a brain, is to experience the world bifurcated, in here, out there. That's the way the system, so to speak, delivers it to us. It can't be any other way. For the Kantians, again, transcendental unity of apperception. Your perceptions are all unitary. If they were not unitary, they would not be connected. So you'd have a sequence of experiences which would have no connection between them. But they're all attributed to a single experiencer. Or rather, they're all part of a single experiencing. Problem is that we think of that single experiencing as belonging to an independent I. The Buddha's seen through that. He's seen that that isn't the case. But he's still experiencing. And his experience still has an inner perceiving dimension and an outer perceived dimension. He still has a stream of energy. He has a stream of volitions. But they are without clinging to self. They're without the delusion of a fixed self. But he still has them. They're still there. They're still going on. He's just able. He's seen through, and he's able to stop clinging onto them, stop identifying those processes in terms of an imputed self and an imputed other. He just experiences those processes flowing on. So what then does it mean when he reveres and relies upon the Dhamma? It means that he puts those processes at the service of the Dhamma. He serves the Dhamma. He puts his energies, these energies that are focused for the time being in his human body, at the service of the Dhamma. It's very simple in a way, but extremely profound when you reflect upon it. He can't avoid having that bifurcated awareness. Can't avoid it because it's part of the structure of experience. But he puts that at the service of the Dhamma. So let's now look at the other side of it. What is this Dhamma that he puts his ordinary self, you could say, empirical self, you know, you understand what I mean by what I refer it to what I've just said, this empirical self, he puts it at the service of the Dhamma. Now, it's not the Dhamma in the sense of he's got a big set of books up on a shelf which he puts himself in service to. It's not the Dhamma as an abstract principle. It's a Dhamma as a living reality. You might even say a living consciousness, because as I was indicating this morning, if we think of it as a principle, we inevitably think of it as less than a person. We think of it like the wind or whatever. But what we're thinking about is something that's more than person. And inevitably, this is why people do start talking about it as God and ascribing a personality to it. Because in some ways, that's a better thing to do than to think of it as merely a natural force or whatever. It's something way beyond personality, but it's not beyond in the sense of being without personality. It's supra-personal. So it's, you could say, like a vast consciousness within which the Buddha experiences his own empirical consciousness, and which he puts his own empirical consciousness at the service of. There's a very impressive passage in Bhante's memoirs when he's, I think that he told me about this the other day. He reminded me about this the other day. He thinks he might have been 13 or 14 or 15, and he was going to take some library books back to Tooting Public Library, which was, I think, a pretty common occurrence, taking the library books back and getting more, big pile of them, no doubt. And he was at Amen Corner, no doubt not without significance. And he said that suddenly he had the experience of, Arjavin will know that very well. His centre is going to be located there. And experience that suddenly all the traffic noise, all the bustle, all the hustle receded and into the distance and became sort of insignificant. And his experience was that as if he was walking through a vast consciousness. He was walking through a vast consciousness. He said this experience persisted for some time and then gradually began to fade, and it happened a number of other times as well. He told me later that what this experience did was convince him that Kant was right, just since we're in the Kantian mood. But we won't go into that further. Satchika will expound upon it later. But Bhante's experience was of his own organism, so to speak, his own psychophysical organism, walking through a vast, infinite consciousness. And that consciousness, one assumes, he didn't say much about it, much more than that about it, but that consciousness, one assumes, wasn't just a sort of bland awareness. It wasn't just a very bright light that he was walking through. That consciousness would have been rich, would have been rich in beauty, rich in love. It would have been intensely bright, but bigger than him, without a limited personality, a vast consciousness. And to me, it's something like that that the Buddha's talking about when he talks about revering the Dhamma. He's talking about the Dhamma not as a set of postulates, not as a theory, not as a teaching even, but as a living experience of reality. Reality as perhaps even, one could say, perhaps only as a metaphor, a vast consciousness which informed his own, but which his own empirical consciousness was within, if you like. So the way I read this then is that the Buddha put his human energies, his human consciousness, at the service of a vast, let's say, consciousness, the Dhamma, the reality of things, which is not just static but dynamic, as the Dhamma Nyama. The Dhamma Nyama is that force pressing up through us, pressing up within us, that when we give ourselves up to it, carries us on to enlightenment. It's the force within reality, within us, that creates Buddhas, out of which Buddhas arise. The Buddha had no obstruction to it anymore. He'd stopped fighting it. He'd completely given himself up to it. In a way, you could say he'd completely become it. But of course, as a you know, a flesh and blood human being with nerve endings and blood, brain cells and all that, there would still be an empirical awareness. And that he put at the service of the Dhamma. This is the way I read it. I'm being a little metaphorical at times, but I hope you understand what I mean. I think it's extremely important. Important not just for an understanding of what the Dhamma is about, but an understanding of our own situation right now. The Buddha was the Buddha. The Buddha had discovered the Dhamma. He'd awoken to the Dhamma. He'd awoken to this reality which is beyond personal and impersonal, but which perhaps we best think of as personal, but on the vastest scale, a vast consciousness, but that's more than consciousness. The Buddha had awoken to that. He put himself at its service. Well, that is what we have to do. That is what we need to remember on this Vaishakha Purnima. We need to put our energies at the service of the Dhamma. That is what we're here for. We need to put ourselves at the service of the Dhamma as we understand it through our teacher, as we understand it from the Buddha, as we experience it as something vaster than ourselves, something sublime that overwhelms us, overmasters us, that's more than we can speak of, something so majestic that we cannot comprehend it. Only we can revere it. We can only fall at its feet, as it were, and put ourselves at its service. That, to me, is the message of the Gaurava Sutta, that we can understand the Buddha better through the sutta, but we can understand our own predicament. We still have an empirical self, and we're still confused about what it really is. We still think that empirical self has a metaphysical reality, has a transcendent reality. We still believe that there is an I somewhere back there, and that there is a world somewhere out there which is fixed, and which is the arena into which we're put to live out our lives. We still, at the back of it all, believe that. We're still caught up in the struggle to find identity. In every moment, if we can't see through it, if we haven't seen through it sufficiently, in every moment that habit that comes from beginningless lifetimes, the Buddha says in, for instance, the Lankavatara Sutta, the habit patterns from limitless lifetimes, this habit of reading our experience in terms of a fixed self, is constant seeking for an identity, a fixed identity, from which there seems to be no relief, agonizing at times. I often quote my dear mother in her bedridden in the last years of her life, and unable to do anything, but still being more than compos mentis. She knew everything that was going on in the house, and quite a lot that wasn't. But she was wide awake. And I remember one day she just lying back and just saying, I'm fed up with being me. You're fed up with this constant recreation of this petty fogging I. I know that from solitary retreat. Yeah, oh, go away, for God's sake. Just go away, well, for anybody's sake. Just go away. This constant, petty, little sort of gossip monger going on in my mind. And talking about this and that. It's all about me. I'm just sick of it. And it's an incredible habit. And even though you've seen what a miserable little wretch it is, it won't go away. And even your reaction to it is part of it, as it were. It's sickening. It just won't go away. Well, what the Buddha says, put that at the service of the Dhamma. I don't mean get, you know, all proud about the Dhamma. I don't mean that. I mean put this psychophysical organism, put even this quest for identity at the service of the Dhamma. Identify with the Dhamma. Become a Dhamma Chari or Dhammacharini, one who is faring on in the Dhamma. Take on that identity. Take on the identity of one who serves the Dhamma. It's still an identity. There's still going to be attachment. There's still going to be reaction when, you know, another person, you know, says something you don't agree with or whatever. But put yourself behind that identity. And then in your service of the Dhamma, that identity will be refined and even ultimately will be exploded, will be seen through. That, to me, is the message for us of the Gaurava Sutta. The Buddha revered and relied upon the Dhamma. He'd seen through and got rid of the tendency to eye-making. He'd seen the house builder. Broken are your rafters. Never will you build this house again, he says in that song of victory immediately after his enlightenment. A wonderful song of victory. And so he doesn't do it anymore. But still, he's got that psychophysical, empirical self, and he puts it at the service of the Dhamma. We're still doing it. But we can put ourselves at the service of the Dhamma, and slowly, through that putting ourselves at the service of the Dhamma, we will be able to go beyond that ahankara. And of course, putting ourselves at the service of the Dhamma, we mustn't think of that in abstract terms. We mustn't think of that as serving a principle. Or we can only think of it as serving a principle if we've got a lively enough and poetic enough idea of a principle. If we can see a principle as something more than an impersonal process. And probably for us, most of us, the best way we can do that is by serving the best and highest of beings. Serving, of course, the Buddha. For us, the Dhamma is embodied in the Buddha. Bhante says that the Buddha, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are at the point on the horizon over which enlightenment appears. Enlightenment is far beyond the horizon, but the Buddha sits on the horizon. And because he sits on the horizon, he's in our world, and he's also in the world of enlightenment beyond it. So when we revere the Buddha, we're revering the Dhamma. We revere our teacher, because the teacher is, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, the teacher is the Buddha for us. That doesn't mean that we think he's all perfect. Doesn't mean we think he's sorted everything out, that he's finished the job and all the rest of it. But it means that through him, we've encountered the Buddha and therefore the Dhamma. I know for myself that I could never have understood to any degree who the Buddha was if I was not a disciple of Sangharakshita. Perhaps somebody else could have done it, but for me, it's my contact with Bhante, seeing Bhante, knowing Bhante, that helps me to understand what the Buddha was. So we also need to revere and rely. That reverence and reliance must be judicious. It must be, as it were, a critical one in the positive sense. It must look closely at ourselves and our own delusions and our own mundane desires. But we need to revere and rely upon something. And we need to revere and rely especially upon our teacher, upon the Buddha, and upon the Dhamma. So these are my reflections for this Vaishakha Purnima, that the Buddha himself needed to revere and rely upon. How much more do we? So let us do so as much and as fully as we can, and commit ourselves to doing so more and more and more over these coming years.